would say would mean anything because we know for a fact that it can't be true. This alloy should weigh 10 times more. Metal doesn't shine light in fancy little patterns, and it sure doesn't move when you put pieces of it together. What science we do have tells us we're looking at a solid chunk of metal, but this has all the physical properties of a complex mechanism. So I'm trying to devise experiments to find out more than what metallurgy says I can find out. I know it sounds a little iffy, and it should. I'm making this up as I go along. I first exposed one of the panels to plutonium-238 and measured its light output. It turns out the parts don't just activate with radioactive material, they feed off it. Any kind of nuclear energy, it would seem. Exposure to even a small amount of radiation increased the light output of the panel by about 0.5%.
Is that how these things power themselves?
That would be my guess. But that's not the interesting part. We had originally managed to cut a small speck off one of the panels for analysis. I had it encased in transparent resin afterward. It was just sitting on my desk as a paperweight. When we noticed an increase in luminosity in the panels, I had the idea to measure how much energy the material could absorb. I put the fragment in a closed environment in direct contact with the plutonium. It turns out the metal does absorb radiation, but it saturates fairly quickly and needs to release the superfluous energy. Upon discharge, it emits a very strong electromagnetic pulse. It knocked out the two computers that were in the room. It's possible the parts emit the same kind of pulse when they activate. It could be what brought down Kara's helicopter in Turkey, though an EMP wouldn't explain why her engine failed. Now that I know what to expect, I'll monitor anything I can think of. I'd also like to see if it feeds off other types of energy.
If it had not been made a cliché by another fellow, I would call this fascinating.
I'm glad you like that, but that's not even the good part. What's really interesting is that it also generates a strong energy field, strong enough to destroy surrounding objects.
What do you mean by destroy? Like an explosion?
No, nothing explodes. The stuff around it is just gone. Vaporized. Without vapor. I was running the experiment in a glass enclosed environment. It made a perfect spherical hole in the glass, surgically precise like a laser. There is no ash, no debris, no trace that the missing matter ever existed.
How much energy could the entire robot absorb?
A whole lot. If that little speck of metal can discharge enough energy to make a 1-foot hole, I can't begin to imagine how much energy kilotons of this material can swallow. Obviously, I can't place any instruments anywhere near it, but once I figure out a way to measure the energy output from the small shard, I can extrapolate a figure for the entire thing.
Could the robot withstand a hit from a missile or a bomb?
It's complicated. Conventional weapons will generate heat, but most of the damage usually comes from kinetic energy. I have absolutely no idea how it handles kinetic energy. I can run some experiments. It might be as simple as putting a sledge to the panels and measuring the light output. I'll think of something. I can tell you we applied some insane amounts of pressure trying to cut a piece off one of the panels. I really don't see how a shock wave could seriously damage her. It might knock her on her back if it's powerful enough. I just don't know enough about weapons.
Do you believe it could withstand a nuclear explosion?
I don't know. Maybe. I think a more important question is how much the sphere is shielded from what happens outside. It might be almost impossible to destroy the robot itself, but it doesn't mean all that much if everyone inside is dead. In any case, if it did survive a nuclear blast, the energy the robot would release would probably be nearly as destructive as the blast itself. Unless it can be focused somehow. The fragment I used only weighs a few grams. It's smaller than the nail of your little finger, and it made a hole about 1 foot in diameter. I'm just now realizing how powerful this thing might be. I must admit she's beginning to scare me.
What do you think she was built for?
Up until now, I tried to ignore the fact that this might very well be a weapon, an enormously powerful weapon. But when I think about it, there's simply no reason to build something this massive for anything else. There's nothing practical about it. She'll weigh about 7,000 metric tons if we manage to put her together. She'll destroy anything she steps on. What worries me is that you could have walked through an army of 10,000 men with something a tenth of this size. There was nothing remotely powerful enough 6,000 years ago to justify a weapon of this magnitude. Nothing of this earth, anyway.
You believe she is that powerful?
We'll just have to locate the head to find out.
We will have all the answers very soon. Unfortunately, we will need to go under the sea to get them.
I thought about that possibility. I'm hoping it's not, because I can't get the Arcana compound to disperse well underwater. It'll take months to develop a new delivery system, and a whole lot longer to go through all the oceans. Whatever I come up with, I can already tell you that dispersal will be a lot slower underwater. With a slower vehicle like a submarine, it could take decades before we find anything. It might be wishful thinking, but I'm really hoping that whoever buried these things was afraid of water.
You misunderstood. What I meant is that I know exactly where the head is. It is beneath the sea. The Bering Sea.
File number 143. Interview with Captain Demetrius Rook, United States Navy. Location: Naval Submarine Base Bangor, Kitsap Peninsula, Washington.
Please state your name and rank.
Captain Demetrius Rook, United States Navy.
What is your current assignment?
I'm in command of the USS Jimmy Carter, designated SSN 23.
If I understand the designation correctly, that is a nuclear attack submarine.
Yes, sir. Seawolf class.
How long have you been in command?
5 years in October, sir.
I'm not part of the military. You do not have to call me, sir.
What would you prefer I call you?
On second thought, sir will be just fine. Please describe, in your own words, the events that occurred on the morning of August 17.
Very well. We left Bangor Base alongside the USS Maine. She's an Ohio-class ballistic missile sub. We were on our way to CFAC in Ketchikan, Alaska, for a week of detection exercises when we got a call from SecNav.
You received a call from the office of the Secretary of the Navy?
No. I mean from the Secretary of the Navy himself.
Does the Secretary of the Navy often call submarine captains directly?
No, he does not. That was unusual in and of itself. His orders were definitely out of the ordinary. We were to intercept two Russian subs in the Bering Sea and secure whatever we found on the site. We were to avoid hostilities, if at all possible, but use of force was authorized if necessary. I don't know if you've ever spoken to SecNav, but he's a very loud man. He speaks slowly with a very deep voice. It's really impossible to misunderstand anything he says, but I asked him to repeat anyway. I don't think a sub-captain has heard those words since World War II. First, we had to head back to Bangor to take an Army chief warrant on board as an advisor. Good-looking girl. We headed west from there. The trip is about 60 hours at maximum speed. She said we were on our way to recover a new kind of power reactor, some new fission technology we couldn't let the Russians get their hands on. Apparently, it was on its way to a secret facility in Alaska when there was an incident, and they had to drop it into the sea. Her helo was escorting the ship, and she was familiar with the device. That's why we had to bring her aboard. She asked to be brought into the control room right away. One of my lieutenants told her we'd send for her when we reached our destination, but she insisted. Some words were exchanged. My XO had to intervene. I didn't think too much of it at first. I thought claustrophobia was getting to her. It's not unusual when people get on a sub for the first time. Tight spaces, small doors, low ceilings. Some people have a hard time adjusting. It can make them irritable. I let her blow a little steam and left it at that.
Did you bring her to the control room?
Not right away, no. I sent for her about 12 hours from our target. She seemed calm and in control. We went around the Alaskan Peninsula and headed north from Dutch Harbor. After about 10 miles, we made sonar contact with three objects. There was an Akula-class sub lying on her side at the bottom of a small cliff. She appeared to be disabled. The St. Petersburg was just sitting there, staring at us, about 2,000 feet west of the Akula.
The St. Petersburg?
Lotta class. She's the lead ship. Really quiet. She was designed for this sort of thing. Blowing up subs, defending a base, things like that. They must have sent her when the Akula stopped responding. Whatever she was guarding, the reactor, she seemed adamant about not letting us anywhere near it.
You do not think it was a power reactor?
It's not my place to say. It was a large object, about 35 feet in diameter, sitting in between her and the disabled Akula. Sonar said it was metallic. When we tried to get closer, the St. Pete maneuvered herself between us and the target. We stopped. The USS Maine tried to go around the Russian sub. We were hoping that having two ships to deal with might make her run. She didn't. She kept her nose straight at us and flooded her torpedo tubes.
What did you do then?
Nothing. Our other boat stopped. We waited. Submarines are slow, clumsy things. A lot of what we do is just sit and wait. We're good at that.
You had orders to fire if necessary.
I didn't think it was necessary, and I wasn't ready to get blown to bits quite yet. We could have taken her down, but not before she fired everything she had at us.
How long did you wait?
About a day. Like I said, we're good at waiting. The next morning, we received an extremely low-frequency warning that a Russian corvette was underway. It would get there in less than 90 minutes. We had to act quickly. A corvette is well-equipped for anti-submarine warfare, and she would no doubt bring the target aboard or tow it away. I gave the order to flood and open our torpedo tubes, and we used the Gertrude to tell the USS Maine to do the same. The Russians responded in kind. That's when things started to get crazy. Our Army guest suggested we surface and warn the Russians that we'd destroy the object before we let anyone have it.
Did you?
No. I had no intention of doing that. There was a corvette coming. Then she asked me, ordered me, would be a better choice of words, to actually do it. Just fire on it, she said. Everything you got. My orders were to recover that object. Fire at the Russians if need be, not to destroy the very thing we came for. Naturally, I said no. She assured me it wouldn't be destroyed, but the blast would force the Russian boat to back off, and we'd gain enough time for the cavalry to arrive. I couldn't even be sure we had boats underway. She called me a fool for arguing with her.
How did you respond?
You're out of order, I believe, was my reply. I told her I would have her removed if she did not desist immediately. Then, and I remember this perfectly because it was the last thing I expected, she raised her voice to make sure everyone in command heard her and said, "I'm assuming command of this ship under the authority given to me by the President of the United States."
Gutsy.
You could call it that. I called for security on the double, and I asked the chief of the boat to place her under arrest. The XO grabbed her by the arm, and then things were a little fuzzy. It was happening so fast. She got the XO in an arm lock and slammed his head on a console. Two armed security officers arrived on deck. She round-kicked one of them and broke the other one's nose with her palm before kneeing him and throwing him down. She must have grabbed a sidearm from one of the men, because the next thing I knew, she had her arm around my throat and a gun to my temple. She backed us up against the wall to get a full view of the room. Four more armed men came through the door. There was a lot of back and forth yelling. I could sense my men were losing their calm, so I asked everyone to lower their weapons. I had to repeat it a few times, but they eventually complied. I asked her what the next move was. She gave me two choices. I could either fire on the object, as she wanted, or surface to confirm her orders. I certainly questioned her motives, but there was no doubt in my mind about her resolve. She would blow my head off, I was sure of it. Yet she remained fairly calm under the circumstances, and I chose to believe she hadn't completely lost her mind. I told her there was no way I would surface with a corvette only minutes away, but I would fire our torpedoes at the object if the USS Maine kept hers aimed at the St. Petersburg. Only I would not do it with a gun to my head. She had to let me go.
She believed you?
I gave her my word as a Navy officer. I took the gun away from her. The XO punched her unconscious, broke her nose in the process, I think. The men dragged her to the brig.
Did you fire?
I gave her my word. We shot two torpedoes at the object. Both were direct hits.
What happened?
Nothing happened. Well, not nothing, but not what you'd expect. When the torpedoes exploded, we braced ourselves for the shockwave that would shortly follow. We were fairly close to the target. The engine went silent. All the lights went out. All we could hear was the metal of the hull shrieking under the pressure. We started to slowly tilt upwards and sideways. We all had to grab a hold of something. We hovered like that for about 6 hours. Then we heard something attaching to the hull. They took us out in a rescue sub, a dozen men at a time. Turns out they had sent a whole lot of boats after us. Several frigates, two destroyers, and a cruiser. They must have been minutes away when it all happened. We could see the St. Petersburg through the window in the rescue sub, or her shadow, actually. There was a lot of bluish light behind her. She was missing part of her tail. A really clean cut, not like an explosion. You'd need a laser or a blowtorch to make a cut that clean. The rescue sub went out to help the Russians. They were lucky. The rear chamber was sealed when their tail was cut off. Only two people had died. I asked the cruiser crew, what of the Akula? They just stared at me blankly. It took several of us to convince them that there was an Akula-class submarine at the bottom when we arrived. One thing's for sure, it wasn't there anymore. Poof, like magic. There was no wreckage, no floating debris, no sign it was ever there.
What happened to the Army Chief Warrant?
Never saw her again. They told me she'd be court-martialed. She must have been right about her orders, I mean.
I thought you said she would be...
They also made it very clear to me that none of this ever happened. I don't think they'll put anyone on trial for something that didn't happen.
Are you always this cynical? You seem to doubt a lot of what you're told.
It's all cockamamie, if you ask me. Military intelligence. They'd come up with these really far-fetched stories, and just because we don't ask questions, they think we're actually buying it. They forget that they're talking to people who are trained not to ask questions. If it were up to me, I'd rather they just didn't tell me anything. It's less insulting than to be lied to.
Do you believe I am lying to you?
That would be hard. You haven't told me a single thing. But let's give it a shot. Can you tell me what it was I fired at? It wasn't destroyed, just like she said. I saw it hooked to a crane when they brought it aboard. But they had it covered in some black sheeting. I fired two torpedoes at that thing.
Let us say for a minute I could provide you with, how shall I put it, an alternate story. I can assure you that you would find it so preposterous that you would leave this room absolutely convinced that you fired your torpedoes at a prototype reactor that was lost at sea. So, I will save both of us the time and leave it at that. I can tell you this. What you did mattered.
Thank you. I guess that's all I really wanted to hear. By the way, that chief warrant, I'd like to shake hands with her sometime. She's got grit.
I will let her know you said hi.
File number 161. Interview with CW3, Kara Resnick. United States Army. Location: Underground Complex, Denver, Colorado.
I can't stand it anymore. I feel like I'm watching him die every day, all the time. If he's not unconscious, he's in agony. No one can stand that much pain all the time. I'm surprised he lasted this long.
He can walk, can he not?
No, he can't. You can't call that walking. You and I are walking. He can barely take a couple steps before his whole body starts shaking. Then he collapses and, to spare us, pretends it doesn't hurt as much as it does. I've had to pick him up from the ground 3 times today. No one wants to hurt him any more than he already is, so no one says anything.
And what would they say if they dared?
He just doesn't have enough muscle mass left.
Is he taking his drugs?
Religiously. But his body's adapting to the muscle-building agent. The doctor says his tolerance will continue to increase.
We will find him new medication.
You can't keep pumping him full of experimental drugs. His body's been through enough already.
Would you rather we let him suffer?
He doesn't have to suffer. Take these things out of him and let him rest. He can learn to walk with prosthetics when he's ready.
You do realize that this project would essentially be over if he lost his legs. You would be willing to throw away all the work that he did, that you did, to spare him some pain for a few weeks?
It's not a few weeks. And if the alternative is to watch him die, then yes, I give up. We're killing him. And it wouldn't have to be over. We can find a way to make the helmet work for someone else. We can rig the controls so he can maneuver with his arms. There are 100 things we can do that don't involve torturing him. This, what we're doing to him, it's just wrong.
From what Dr. Franklin tells me, we are decades, if not centuries, away from fully understanding the technology behind the helmet. I would also point out that you and Mr. Mitchell, a man in tremendously better shape than Mr. Couture, have worked countless hours in the sphere and were able to make her walk only for a few steps. You cannot seriously suggest that Mr. Couture could control robotic legs with his hands and operate the console with any kind of efficiency. That would be putting his life and yours at risk. Mr. Couture is a grown man. Why not let him make his own decisions?
No. Of course he'll take new drugs if you give him a choice. He'd do anything to get the project back on track.
Some would call that dedication. I would hardly call it a problem.
It's not just his body that's messed up. He's changed.
Is he depressed?
No. Quite the opposite. He says this ordeal's made him see things differently. He keeps telling us how much he appreciates every little thing. You should see him with me. He's kind. He's attentive. Scares the hell out of me.
It is not uncommon for people to find positive aspects in a negative situation.
I get that. I've heard it before. Life's taught me a great lesson. I now realize what the important things in life are. I even think it's true sometimes, but this doesn't feel right. That's not who he is. I think he's on the verge of a mental breakdown, and he's finding ways of holding on to his sanity for as long as he can.
It is kind of you to worry about your friend, but I honestly believe he is making astounding progress, physically and mentally. Speaking of physical progress, how's your nose healing up? Are you still having trouble breathing?
It's kind of me to worry about my friend. You ought to listen to yourself sometimes. My nose is fine. I still have to breathe through my mouth when I sleep, but it's getting better. They said I'll need plastic surgery if I want to get rid of the scar. I'm not sure I want to. It's a shame the helmet doesn't come down that far. I could have saved a nose job.
That was a bold move you made. They could have shot you. They should have shot you. Do you realize how dangerous that was?
I know. It's not like I planned any of it. They were either going to get us all killed or let the Russians take the head. I've never been really afraid of dying, but it would feel damn stupid to get so close to that last piece and let it slip away. I tell myself it was a calculated risk, but the truth is I acted on instinct. They just made me mad.
An impulsive reaction is to be expected in your case. I am curious as to how you knew the head would not be destroyed.
You can call it an educated guess. You know I've helped Dr. Franklin run some experiments. I assumed that if a tiny speck of metal could absorb a lot of energy, something that massive could withstand a couple of torpedo hits. I know. You're going to tell me it wasn't up to me to take that chance, that I could have ruined everything.
I am not going to tell you anything of the sort. I chose you because of who you are. I sent you there for the same reason. Quite frankly, I would have fired myself. I am curious, however, as to how you knew it would disable the submarines. If my understanding is correct, an electromagnetic pulse does not travel underwater, and if it did, a submarine would likely be shielded from it.
I thought about that, but an EMP shouldn't have done anything to my helicopter either. It's hardened against that, and yet it stopped my engine cold twice. Whatever this thing shoots out, it's nasty. If it didn't work, the shockwave from the explosion might have at least pushed the Russians away.
They are still searching for the other Russian submarine.
I feel sorry for those people. I didn't think it would destroy their ship.
Obliterate might be a better term. All that is left is a crescent-shaped hollow on the cliffside and some very confused seamen.
Won't they report what happened when they get back?
What could they report? The other submarine was there, and then it was not. Their ships were there, and they know we did not leave with the submarine. What matters is that we recovered the head. Have you attached it yet?
No, we haven't even unwrapped it. Dr. Franklin wants us to try everything we can on the console before we attach the head. If we can see the result on the hologram first, we can avoid accidents when she's functional.
I thought curiosity would have the better of you.
Well, it would have had the better of me. I would have put that thing on the minute we got back. At least we'd know if it works, right? Then, out of nowhere, Vincent was back to his old self for a few seconds. He said, "One of those buttons could be a self-destruct." It was nice to catch a glimpse of him again. His eyes, they haven't been the same since the accident, but he looked at me like he used to for a moment. Of course, I didn't have anything smart to say after that. We all agreed to work on the console while Vincent gets better. We didn't find a self-destruct, but we did find the command to disassemble her. There is a small button on the top left of the console. If you press it long enough, she lays down on her stomach, arms along her sides, and all the parts disconnect from one another. At least they do in the hologram. There's a hatch on top of the sphere for us to get out, since the sphere will stay level, but I don't know how we'll be able to reach it.
Have you discovered any weaponry?
Not yet, but it could be weeks before we try every sequence on the console. And some of the controls seem to have no effect on the hologram. These could be your weapons.
My weapons?
You know what I mean. All we can see right now is what makes her move. If there's a button that makes her eyes shoot little turquoise lightning bolts, we won't know until we can do it for real. We'll have to figure out these things once she's assembled if Vincent recovers enough strength.
You mean when he recovers his strength?
Sure. That's what I meant. Promise me you won't push him.
You make it sound as if I could control him in some way. I cannot force him to do anything he does not want to.
You sort of can. That's the thing. He listens to you. Don't ask me why. I can't, for the life of me, figure out why he'd trust you of all people, but he does. Don't abuse that trust.
You and I both know that Mr. Couture puts more faith in your opinion and that of Dr. Franklin than he will ever put in anything I have to say. To suggest otherwise is simply preposterous.
No, he trusts us. He trusts me for just about everything. But he knows how much I care about him, and Dr. Franklin, too. He knows we'll always have his interests at heart. I guess in some weird way he trusts your objectivity more.
Do you believe I have lost my objectivity?
Lost it? No. I don't think you really had any to begin with. I don't see how anyone can come into this and remain objective. Dr. Franklin is a scientist. If anyone can remain detached, it should be her. But she's not a robot. She's curious. She's proud. She can't help but be blinded to certain things because of what motivates her. The same thing is true for me, and it's blatantly true for you. You have your own agenda, and you're willing to go the distance for it. I'm not saying you're in this for your own personal gain. I think, in many ways, your motivation might actually be less selfish than everyone else's. But that doesn't make you any less biased. The only difference between me and you when it comes to Vincent is that you really don't care what happens to him if he can't do this. That's not objectivity.
I can accept and even understand that you might question my motives. I find it more difficult not to respond when my integrity is questioned. Have I ever lied to you?
1,000 times, I'm sure. Just don't lie to him. That's all I'm asking.
I suppose I should be offended. Has it ever occurred to you to ask Mr. Couture if he believes I have misled him in any way? He is an incredibly intelligent young man, more so than either you or I could ever aspire to be.
Come on. Be honest for 1 second. If he said, no, I don't want to do this anymore, you wouldn't try to force him to continue, manipulate him, blackmail him, threaten him in some way?
Who is being manipulative now? There are 2 possible answers to this question. One that you would not believe, and one that would make me a cruel and evil figure. So I can either appear cruel and dishonest, or honest but still cruel and evil. You have formulated a question for which the best possible answer is to admit that I am a dangerous, manipulative blackmailer. You will forgive me if I do not give you the pleasure of answering it. Fortunately for me, your question is entirely speculative, as Mr. Couture has expressed on several occasions, and to the both of us, his strong desire to help with this project in any way that he can. If, at some point in the future, his disposition changes and he wishes to remove himself from his enterprise, then you will have the only answer that really matters, and we will know if I am everything you portray me to be. In the meantime, I hope you will not presume to know more about the needs and wants of Mr. Couture than he does, and that you will honor and respect the wishes of the man you claim to love.
File number 182. Personal Journal Entry. Dr. Rose Franklin, Ph.D. Location: Underground Complex, Denver, Colorado.
We knew the world would not be the same. A few people laughed. A few people cried. Most people were silent. I remember the line from the Hindu scripture, the Bhagavad Gita. Vishnu is trying to persuade the prince that he should do his duty, and to impress him, takes on his multi-armed form and says, "Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds." I suppose we all thought that, one way or another. Those are not my words. In fact, I had to look up the exact quote. Like everyone else, I only knew, "I am become death, the destroyer of worlds." We tend to romanticize good quotes, and I always imagined Oppenheimer uttering those words while staring at the mushroom cloud of a nuclear explosion. In reality, he spoke those words during an interview for an NBC documentary in 1965. He had had 20 years to think about it. I've been giving a lot of thought to Oppenheimer and the Manhattan Project these past few days. I haven't been building a bomb, but it's becoming increasingly difficult to ignore a very simple truth. I am building a weapon, and a formidable one at that. But that's not the truth I'm hiding from. There's no hiding from that. I spend most of my time understanding just how devastating it can be. I realize it may have been an instrument of peace, but not the kind of peace achieved through righteousness and understanding. This is meant to be a killing machine. One of such might and power that no one would stand against it. It works. I'm afraid of it. I'm reminded of it every night in my dreams. All of us are. I keep showing up earlier and earlier in the morning, either because I can't sleep or because I don't want to go back to whatever dream I was having. Inevitably, someone's already there, or they show up a few minutes later. No one wants to talk about it, but we can all tell we're going through the same thing. My dream is usually the same. She's standing over me, then she bends on one knee and brings her face a few feet above my head. She's staring at me with bright, blinding turquoise eyes. She looks like she's about to speak. That's when I wake up in a sweat. After yesterday, I know I won't have the same dream ever again. We finally looked at the head. Everyone was dying to see it. It had just been sitting there, wrapped in a black tarp. I'd catch Kara trying to take a peek about once a day. I could have just unwrapped it, but it was too much fun torturing her. She would pace around it for 20 minutes, hoping the tarp would magically fall off, and then she'd walk off angrily. Yesterday morning, I brought Vincent in his wheelchair, and I told Kara it was time. We unstrapped the head and removed the cloth. She is stunning, but not at all what I expected. She has thin lips and a very small nose. All her features are small, delicate. She almost looks like a child, innocent, but controlled. Chaste is the word that comes to mind. I can't decide if it's her hair or a very elaborate helmet, but her head is covered in wavy spines with intricate carvings. Turquoise light seeps between them. Some extend forward onto her cheeks and brow. Others are sleeked backward toward her back armor. From her forehead, several spines join to form an axe-shaped appendage at the back of her head. When we unwrapped her, I was expecting to cross the same intense gaze I see in my dreams, quailing at the idea, to be honest, but it wasn't there. No blinding light. No gaze. No eyes. She doesn't have eyes, only small recesses where they ought to be. It's very unsettling. You can't help but wonder just how aware of your presence she really is. I know she's not aware of anything because I'm the one who put her together. But there's something about her. A presence. I think there's more there than a glorified toaster. Besides, I can't really be blamed for anthropomorphizing something that's anthropomorphic. Anyway, I doubt she'll leave me alone at night. But she'll have to find another way to scare me. We had to use two cranes to raise the head. As soon as we attached it, the whole room started to shake. Her entire body stiffened for a second, then everything went back to normal. I asked Kara to grab a walkie-talkie, get up the elevator and into the sphere. She went in and braced herself at her station. I asked her to raise her right arm slowly. It was fantastic to watch. She moves. After all this, we finally got her working. We made her move her arms, rotate her head. She even bent down to pick up a storage crate. She's really gracious, delicate in her movements. I didn't expect such fluency. Of course, she crushed the crate with her fingers, but we can work on that. Kara's not that delicate herself. We found weapons today. I haven't told our nameless friend yet. He'll find out soon enough. I just don't want to give him the pleasure of pretending he hasn't been waiting for this all along. We came upon them by accident. I was expecting we'd find weaponry at some point, but not so soon. And I always thought it would be lasers, a death ray, something futuristic. Maybe I just watched too many movies. I was wrong. It turns out our girl is old school. She has a sword and a shield. Apparently, she was built for close combat. I don't know what she was supposed to fight, but it must have been big. The sword is a focused energy weapon. Like a lightsaber, only wider, double-edged. More like a medieval sword. Star Wars meets Lord of the Rings. It's not turquoise, like everything else. It's a very, very bright white. It's almost impossible to stare at. What's really, I seem to use the word cool a lot these days, is that we can dial its length on the console. Vincent figured out that it works on a 64-step scale, one being the shortest, 64 the longest. At the lowest settings, it's almost like a dagger. At its longest, it's... We made a large hole on the floor when we tried it at 64. We stopped playing with it after that. Fortunately, the shield is somewhat safer to experiment with. It's also based on controlled energy, and we can adjust the size in the very same way. At the lowest setting, it barely covers her wrist. At the highest, it can cover her entire body. It's also not nearly as bright as the sword. It's almost transparent, in fact. You can tell something's there because it distorts light a little bit, like the exhaust of a car on a really hot day. We discovered it can also be used as a weapon. It took another hole in the wall this time to figure that one out, but the edge of the shield is very sharp, if you can say that about light. The light in both the sword and shield appears to be self-contained. There's no sign of an electromagnetic field around either of them. Needless to say, I have no idea how they're able to manipulate photons as if it were regular matter. Yet they seem to do with light as they please, like a sculptor would mold clay. We haven't found any long-range weapons so far, but I'm certain we will. She's full of surprises. There needs to be a way for her to focus the energy release away from her. If she does, I'm sure that weapon will have a pretty long reach. She really needs to be able to control it, or she'd be more of a danger to her own army than to the enemies. All one would need to do is throw enough power at her, and she'd obliterate everyone around. I wouldn't want to be anywhere near her when she gets into a fight. On the other hand, if she can focus all that energy in one direction, she'd be a nightmare to deal with. Everything one would hit her with, she would throw right back. The more powerful the enemy, the mightier she would be. That I have told already. But I hope we don't find out for a long, long time. It's important for the powers that be to know that we have yet to uncover her more destructive powers. I fear they'll take her away from us the minute they believe there's no more weaponry to be found. We must use the time we have to discover as much as we can about how she works and what she can do besides leveling a city or vaporizing an army. I haven't told Vincent anything, but I think he understands. All we need now is to make her walk. We'll have to wait before we take her for a spin. Vincent's not ready. He can barely walk himself. I hate to say it. We've already lost several months because of his injury, and I know Kara's more than eager to resume training, but it's a miracle Vincent's lasted this far. To push him any farther would jeopardize everything. I would never tell him, because it would only make things worse, but I can't stomach what they've done to him. I understand the appeal. There's even a reasonably sound logic behind it. But we must draw the line somewhere if we're to remain human. He hasn't tried reversing his knees yet. He wants to, but I don't. If I understand correctly, it's going to rip apart whatever muscle he has left on the back of his legs. They're just too short. It'll take months for him to build muscles that fit his new anatomy. I realize that won't happen if he doesn't try his knees, but he's already in pain 24 hours a day. I'm not going to put him through even more. And it's not in anyone's interest to push Vincent to do something he's not ready for. It'll break him physically and mentally. It will bring resentment, mistrust, and will put every member of my team at unnecessary risk. I know he'll have to try them at some point. I don't think it'll be easier or any less painful if he does it a month from now. In fact, it'll probably be more painful because he'll have gained some muscle mass. But I'm hoping he'll have gained some strength as well, physically and mentally. All that said, I can't wait to see her walk. So, what's that simple truth I've been hiding from? It's not that I'm building a weapon. It's not even that it'll kill people. That's just a matter of time. What I've been trying so hard to deny is that I'm loving every minute of it. As much as I'd like to be principled enough to walk away from this, I'm having the time of my life. I'm a scientist, and this is what I breathe for. If I can learn to live with that, I might be able to sleep again. I tried to find out what Oppenheimer's thoughts were while it was all happening. He had this to say in 1945. But when you come right down to it, the reason that we did this job is because it was an organic necessity. If you are a scientist, you cannot stop such a thing. If you are a scientist, you believe that it is good to find out how the world works, that it is good to find out what the realities are, that it is good to turn over to mankind at large the greatest possible power to control the world and to deal with it according to its lights and its values.
File number 188. Preliminary report. Disappearance of Flight Iceland Air 670. FAA Office of Accident Investigation and Prevention. Flight Iceland Air 670, FI-670, scheduled for a nonstop flight from Denver International Airport, DEN, to Keflavik, Reykjavik, KEF, disappeared from air traffic control instruments at approximately 10:31 on the morning of August 10. The Boeing 757-200, called ready for taxi from gate A43 of Denver International Airport, at 10:16. Following instructions from Denver Ground, the plane taxied to runway 17L through taxiways M and ED, holding short of the runway before contacting the tower. Flight 670 was cleared for takeoff immediately after assuming position on the runway. The entire communication between the tower and FI-670 is reproduced below. Prior communication with ATC shows nothing out of the ordinary. FI-670. Tower, this is Ice Air 670, holding on Echo Delta for runway 17 left. ATC. Good morning, Ice Air 670. She's all yours, into position on runway 17 left. FI-670. Roger that. In position, 670. ATC. Ice Air 670, you are clear to take off. Runway 17 left. Contact departure 1261 in the air. 670, you're clear to go. Ice Air 670, I lost you on my screen. Can you read back? FI 670. Where the hell is that light coming from? ATC. Can you repeat that, 670? Ice Air 670, this is the tower. Please respond. 670, please respond. Investigators were on site around 12:15 p.m., and FAA personnel were denied access to the site. However, the abundant news footage of the incident showed that only the southernmost section, estimate 200 feet, of runway 17L35R, remained intact. A large crater, approximately 1,500 feet across, 300 feet deep, covered the remaining part of the runway and the surrounding taxiways. The examined footage shows no sign of wreckage, no debris of any kind. The complete absence of evidence, coupled with the extraordinary nature of the circumstances, strongly suggests that neither mechanical failure nor pilot error are responsible for the disappearance of Flight 670, and that the aircraft could not be responsible for the destruction of runway 17L35R. The circumstances of the incident, while currently unexplained, clearly fall beyond the expertise of the FAA, and no further investigation is warranted at this point. File number 189. Interview with Vincent Couture, Senior Intelligence Advisor, DCIPS. Location, Fort Carson Army Base, near Colorado Springs, Colorado.
I don't want to start at the beginning. Can we just stop? I don't want to talk. I just need a few minutes to think. Where's Rose? I didn't see her. Where's Kara? I want to see Kara.
Take a deep breath. You need to relax. I only want to help you remember.
Remember what? Where's...
No, do not try to get up.
Where are my boots?
Let us start with something simple. Tell me the first thing you did this morning.
Someone took my boots. What's this? Is it a hospital gown? I can't find any of my clothes.
Please get back into bed. At least sit down on the bed.
My clothes!
I will help you find your clothes. Now, sit down and look at me. I want you to focus on me. What is the first thing you did when you woke up this morning?
This morning, I took a shower and I went to the lab. I got to the lab early.
Very good. What did you do once you got there?
When I got where?
To the lab. You got up early and you went to the lab.
Yes.
What did you do at the lab?
I practiced walking. I walked a few times around the lab, then I tried it with my knees reversed.
Good. I did not know that you had tried them yet.
A few times.
How does it feel?
How does what feel?
Your knees. How does it feel when you reverse them?
It hurts like you wouldn't believe. I tried them last week for the first time. Rose kept telling me to wait, not to rush things. I assumed you had talked to her. I'm not sure if you know how they work, but you have to stick your finger under the kneecap and push real hard. That hurts, just by itself. But the knees are spring-loaded, and they just yank your legs backward real hard. It's overwhelming. I fell face-first the first few times. It hurts like hell. It's like having a truck run over your legs.
Go on.
This
morning, you went to the lab early.
Yes, I did. I got there before anyone else.
And you tried your knees.
I wanted to see if I could go around the room. I made it about two-thirds of the way, then I fell down and I couldn't get up. It's really hard to get up with the legs in reverse.
What did you do then?
After I fell? Nothing. I just lay on my back and waited for someone to come. Rose came in about a half hour later. She brought my wheelchair over and helped me up. She had cinnamon buns, coffee and cinnamon buns. There's this little tiny shop about 2 kilometers from the airport. They make the best pastries.
What happened after Dr. Franklin helped you get up?
We sat down and talked politics while waiting for Kara. She showed up around 9. She whined for a good 15 minutes because we ate all the buns. Rose promised to go get some more and we made our way up into the sphere. We tried the shield again, then the sword. I asked Kara if she was up for a quick walk around the room. We radioed Rose. She didn't think it was a good idea. She told us to practice handling the shield at different sizes. We did for a while, but I could tell Kara also had that walk in the back of her head. I flipped to my knees again. I took a minute to get through the sting, then I braced myself in the controls. "Are you sure you're up for it?" she said. Since I didn't answer, she got out of her station and helped me get into mine. It's cold in here. Where are we? Is this a military base?
It does not matter right now. Just keep going.
I want to see Kara. She was with me. Is she here?
I will answer all your questions in a minute. I just want you to tell me what happened next. You braced yourself in. You were about to try walking for the first time.
We did. I had taken off my headset, but I could hear Rose getting worried. What's going on up there? What are you guys doing? Talk to me. I lifted my left leg. It took us aback for a second. The whole room began to tilt slightly when the sphere adjusted to the movement. I moved my right leg, then the left again. Rose was trying to stay calm. Okay, you did it. Now stop and get out of there. I told Kara we'd go to the end of the room and back. I could feel my legs going numb, but I was too excited to stop. I took a few more steps, then my knees started to give. I never had to support more than my own weight with my knees backward, and I had to swing my hips upward and back at every step to keep the balance. I don't want to talk anymore. Can you take me to see Kara?
I understand. It will only take a minute. You can ask any question you want afterward. It is important you tell me everything that you remember.
Kara and I tried walking for the first time. We just wanted to get to the end of the room.
Yes, your legs were weakening.
Oh, I told you. My left knee folded about 3 steps from the end of the room. Kara was quick enough to raise her hand to the side to stop us from falling headfirst into the wall. I fell forward, both hands on the console. It was the strangest feeling, with my hands pressed against 2 buttons. I realized we hadn't tried that before, 2 buttons at the same time. I was getting excited and trying to calculate how many combinations were possible when I realized I had a hard time concentrating because of the noise. I hadn't noticed it a second before, but it was getting louder.
What noise are you referring to?
Hissing. The pitch was getting higher and higher. It was like a camera flash charging, only much, much louder. Then the hissing stopped. It was complete silence. Everything turned white outside the sphere. It got so bright, we had to cover our eyes. After a second or two, I felt the room darken slowly through my fingers. I looked around. It was as if we'd been transported to another place. There was no roof anymore. I realized it was the sky above us. We were in the middle of a perfectly round crater, maybe half a kilometer across. Kara looked up. I saw the head tilt backward above my head. The ledge was at least 500 feet higher than we were. There was a large plane right on the edge. It was missing the tail end. My legs felt perfectly fine as I spun the robot around to take a look behind us. There was a large building that stopped where the crater began. Most of the lights were out, but we could see the neon sign from our bar. It was Terminal B. Most of Terminal B. Minutes went by before Kara told me to look up. There were 3 or 4 helicopters circling above us. I don't think they were military.
No, they were not. Those were television helicopters. Our little secret is now on every television station in the world. What did you do after you saw them?
We got out of our controls and sat on the floor in the middle of the room. Kara wrapped her arms around me and helped me lie down. We held each other for, I don't know, it seemed like hours without saying a word. I must have fallen asleep. How did we get down?
A Delta team took you down with a tower crane.
It seemed like a long time. I'm so sorry. I'm so terribly sorry. We just... I thought you wanted us to move faster. I thought Rose did too, but she would never say it. I don't... We lost everything, didn't we? All our notes, everything. I don't know what to say. I'll find a way to make this right. We can fix this.
I do not believe this, as you call it, can be fixed. We can only try to move forward from here.
The helicopters. Is that going to be a problem?
Will it be the end of our project? I do not know. I know things will become complicated.
Now can I ask where we are?
This is the base hospital at Fort Carson. You were flown here after they took you and Ms. Resnick out of the device.
I don't remember flying. I don't remember anything after we lay down on the floor.
They gave you a sedative. You were in shock. You became agitated when they tried to take you out of the sphere. They had to restrain you.
Where's Kira? I want to see her. Is she okay?
She's fine. She's in a room a few doors